the 11th of March, and it is now 12:53 in the afternoon. And what we had been discussing was the period of renegotiating the contract with David Friedman Company about 1980 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And you had said that you were on the ranch committee and had sort of not been involved in the final negotiation. How did the meeting with the workers
Well, I was involved in the negotiations from the first and preparing for the negotiations. The ranch committee began putting out leaflets in April, preparing the crews for these negotiations and saying, what are your demands and what is most important and what kind of wage is fair? And we were shooting for $5 an hour. Mm-hmm. I think our initial proposal may even have been higher than that.
How big a jump would that have been?
Over a dollar, because the contract that Eliseo Medina had negotiated was at $3.25, and then went to $3.35, and then $3.50. I think that was, I should have looked at my notes and seen, but it was somewhere in that area. But inflation had been so tremendous in 1978, 79, 1980, that we were falling behind. It looked like a wonderful contract when we wrote it, mm-hmm. but we were falling behind. And for whatever reason, La Paz couldn't send anyone down to initiate the negotiations until so late. And then when Gilbert Padilla arrived, we pretty quickly submitted our first proposals. We were, on the part of the ranch committee and the workers, we'd done our homework. We were ready. And Gilbert stepped right in and submitted our proposals. And the company hemmed and hawed, and then they couldn't meet this day, and they couldn't meet that day, but they'd have their counterproposal on such and such a day. And when they came back with a counterproposal, they offered a wage raise over the old rate of 2 cents, the 2 pennies. And the workers, when we went back to the workers, and there was an assembly of about 1,000 workers that had stayed after work out at the ranch, and we went back to report to them, and they were furious. And their immediate reaction was, well, go, that we're never going to get a strike while the grapes are still on the vines unless we go on strike tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And Gilbert said, no, good faith negotiations, and we've got another meeting set up for a day after tomorrow, and just have to have patience, but we're going to get a contract, but don't go on strike. And the workers said, no, you don't know what you're talking about. It's very late. Every day that we pick another box of grapes, we have less bargaining power with the grower, that when the grapes are finished in the first week in July, our negotiating position is zero, and we've lost the contract. And you're being very naive. The company is just playing you along and delaying things while they get the harvest picked, and you don't know what you're doing. And people that had been drinking began throwing beer bottles.
Oh, Lord.
And Gilbert felt he'd been insulted by the workers, said, as far as I'm concerned, if you don't want me here, I'm going back to La Paz. And the workers began yelling, go back to La Paz. Which the situation was very much out of control, and no one else on the ranch committee wanted to speak. And here was the only Anglo on the committee. And I got up and pleaded in my terrible Spanish in front of 1,000 workers that, you know, we all knew it was late in the day, but the way to deal with things was to go to work in the morning and call meetings in all the crews and get all the crews ready so that when we did go out on strike, it was planned. But it would be disastrous to just go off on our own, mm-hmm. And think we could win a strike against the company without the union behind us. And the workers then turned to Rudy Reyes, who was not on the committee at that time, and Ahmed Shaibi, who was a Yemeni and also not on the committee at that time, and said, you're our new leaders, and you organize the strike for tomorrow. And as of that moment, in effect, the workers had voted to go on their own, to do it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So the committee went back to Mecca Vineyards, where Gilbert was staying, and Gilbert was furious, and furious that the committee couldn't control the workers, and furious at the workers, and furious at the insults. And my feeling was, I should defend, the workers. Because I felt the workers knew what they were talking about, that it was very late. And that, yes, a wildcat strike was wrong, but that they were right. Gilbert was being naive in thinking that a leisurely course of negotiations was going to get a set contract.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, we want you to stay, Gilbert. We, the committee, want you to stay and lead these negotiations, but you've got to be in front of the workers, not behind them. And yes, we should keep negotiating in good faith, but we should start calling meetings of the workers during work, we should start slowing down, and we should make it very clear to the company that we're in charge here. And that's when we began having practically daily meetings on company time, in which we would, and the ranch committee would decide the day before whether we were going to work till 8:30, which was first break, or work till 11:30, which was lunch, or work all day. Or we decided, the committee decided, and that's when we would tell the foreman in the morning how long we were going to work. And that night, I called Rudy Reyes, who was my compadre. He was my best man at my wedding and a very close friend. I said, this is going to be a disaster if you split. And Rudy said, well, the workers have voted for it, and the workers decide, and it's the power of the people, and we're going to go out, and you can keep negotiating till you're blue in the face, but we're not going to pick. Mm-hmm. And at about, I'd say about midnight that night, the police called up my house and talked to my wife, and where is Pato? And she said, he's in bed, and they said, well, their box is burning at Friedman, and we think he is responsible, and we want to talk to him. And she said, he's in bed, and go to hell. She hung up on him. And so I had told Rudy I would be out. I told Rudy I would go out there. I think Rudy called me back at around 2. And he said, you're right. We haven't been able to contact workers from a lot of the crews. What it had turned out is, out of 11 crews, the people that were the strongest were the people from crews number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the top seniority crews. They had stayed after work for this meeting. They were all there. They were the real strong ones. The other crews, the weaker crews, no, they hadn't stayed around. They weren't as strong. They were newer. In effect, the Wildcat Committee hadn't been able to contact any of them. None of them knew there was going to be a strike. To have a strike would mean they would show up and go to work, and the Wildcatters would have to pull them out on a strike not authorized by the union. Rudy realized they'd made a mistake, that they had overplayed their hand, and he called me back and he said, if you can help me, meet me at the Friedman Company at 3:30, and his workers come in, we'll tell them that there isn't a strike, go to work, but their meetings at, and I've forgotten whether we were going to meet at 8:30 or whatever, and discuss the offer, and call for a general meeting of the membership after work, but no strike, no work stoppage. So I was out there at 3:30 or 4 and talking to every car, and company's only offering 2 cents, and we're going to have a meeting after work today, and talk to your steward at the break time, and blah, blah, blah. But go to work and pick the grapes for one more day. And that was our message, for one more day. And the company also got the message that they had overplayed their hand, that the workers were furious, absolutely enraged, and that the goodwill that the company had, they'd burned up. They'd lost it. So all of a sudden, there was a very heightened sense of la prisa, that time was running out and it's time to get down and negotiate. And after that, day after day, there was much better faith negotiation on the part of the growers, but also the workers began coming in, going out, we'd meet, we'd work, we'd slow down. There was one day when, I've forgotten what the, La Tortuga was the name of the day, the turtle. And you go very, very slowly. And there was another day, and I've forgotten all the different days, but, and the meeting, we didn't quite get $5 an hour, but wrapped up negotiations at close to $5 an hour, I think. And it was just, it was too late. We were running out of time and had reached an agreement on everything. And one of the final clauses that the company had refused to bend on was a funeral leave. And I remember after we pretty much reached agreement on everything and were planning to go back to work, you know, and one of the longtime union members, in this freak accident, a gun fell off a car and killed him. And we were meeting, the ranch committee was meeting for that night and deciding what to do the next day. And someone suggested, yeah?
So the growers were objecting to allowing a funeral leave, and now you've got someone who was shot.
It was a clause that some contracts had and some contracts didn't, and we weren't going to go on strike for that clause. The contract negotiations, in effect, were over. We had a contract we could live with. But the committee decided, out of respect to Mr. Ceja, we would stop work the next day and everyone would fly black flags. We'd drive around the ranch in caravans and then leave at 8:30 at break time. And Gilbert said, well, it's not going to affect the contract. It's not going to affect negotiations. You're not going to get an extra nickel out of this. You're going to lose half a day's work for nothing. And the committee decided that it wasn't for nothing. It was for respect. Mm-hmm. And that this was a way to give our respect to Mr. Ceja, and also to just remind the company that we hadn't gotten everything we wanted, but they realized that if they wanted the grapes picked, we were part of the equation at every step of the way. And as it happened out, this is a kind of amusing anecdote for ending the negotiations, but as it happened, Lionel had invited out his banker from Wells Fargo or Bank of America or whatever, and was driving him around the fields as part of the process of renegotiating whatever loan he had outstanding, and had picked this day because negotiations were pretty much over and everything would be peaceful. And all of a sudden at 8:30, all the workers stopped work and these car caravans began going through the fields with the black flags and honking the horns. And the banker apparently asked Lionel what was going on, and Lionel said, I have no idea. And the banker said, Lionel Steinberg is the owner of the David Friedman Company. The banker said, I thought everything was over. Your union problems were over. And Lionel said, so did I. But that was kind of a footnote to negotiations. But the workers were part of the equation. And the David Friedman Company was just very special in the sense that...
Did Padilla actually go back to La Paz, or did he stay in the negotiations?
He finished the negotiations, and we couldn't have done it without him. And he's a very skilled negotiator, and I don't want to discredit him at all. Mm-hmm. But it's also a reminder that even the best negotiator and a founder of the union, can come down from Union headquarters in La Paz, and his job is to listen to the workers.
Yes.
And his job is to serve the workers. And yes, he does know how to negotiate better than the workers in the field, maybe, but they also know things and are aware of things that he is not aware of. Mm-hmm. And it's their ranch and their contract, and his job is to serve them to the best of his abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Gilbert dearly, but his job is to serve us. And my job on the ranch committee was to serve the members.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very dangerous when the leaders of the union are sure they know what's best for the workers, because in general, the workers know what's best for the workers. And if you have faith in the workers, usually that's a good place to start. We make mistakes, no doubt about it, but that's a good place to start. I wanted to touch on a couple of other things about work at the Friedman Company. The strength of the union at the David Friedman Company was the steward system. And every crew had a steward that was elected by the crew and represented their interests. So if there was a problem in the crew, someone was fired or someone was working too slow or someone insulted someone, the worker, if he was being threatened by the foreman or the supervisor, the foreman or the supervisor had to go to the steward and tell them what was happening, and describe what was happening. And the steward might decide that the worker had been drinking. There were cases where the foreman would come to me and say, here's the can, and he's drunk, and he can't work, and he should go home. And I would agree. Mm-hmm. And there were other times when the foreman would come to me and say, we found him drinking in the fields, and I would say, can you give him one more chance? And we'd work something out, maybe one more chance, or go home today, but you can come back tomorrow. Or, I mean, I would always try to defend the worker, but there are cases where, yeah, the worker obviously was at fault. The union had training programs, especially in the 70s and early 80s, had training programs for the stewards, where the steward was really trained in the contract and the benefits, and how to maximize the benefits for the members of the crew. And for instance, you'd work the way the insurance system worked, a very complicated system for anybody. I mean, insurance systems are complicated. And in the early contracts, a lot of people got frustrated with the insurance system because the papers would come back, you didn't sign on page number 2, you didn't have the date, the wife didn't sign, we don't have the social security number of the child. I mean, so many things can go wrong when you're filling out papers, and people would get frustrated. So again, the stewards were trained to help people filling out the papers, make sure everything was right, get the signatures in the right place, but also what the maximum benefits were. If you worked, and I think it was 60 hours. If you worked 60 hours in the calendar month, say in the pruning would start the first week in December, you had 6 months, 60 hours in December. There was a month in which the hours were processed and sent to La Paz and fed through the computer, and your benefits were in March. Okay, it's a complicated enough system, so you need to explain it to the workers. And so one of the first leaflets we would hand out at the David Friedman Company would be welcoming people back to the crew in December. And remember that your hours that you're building up in December will give you union benefits in March. So that if they had a problem So if you had a problem in January, you're not covered yet. But you could buy insurance to extend it for those periods when you weren't employed. And I've forgotten, it was 100 a month or something or other. It started at 40 a month, I think, but it kept going up. But you could extend it. And if you had a family, it made sense to extend it. And again, it was the steward's job to make sure that families understood that. The pruning would end up in January. Well, you'd usually have 60 hours in January. And those would cover you, with February as the down month, they would cover you in March. So if you worked December, January, you were covered in February and March. But we would, again, urge people, remember, even though you're on layoff, you have these benefits. Mm-hmm. You never know when you're going to be sick. But certainly, if your wife is pregnant, you can pretty much guess when the delivery date is going to be by extensions for that coverage. So for sure, you're covered the month of the due date. Once we had vision plan and dental plan, we'd put in the leaflet, even though you're on layoff in February and March, now's the time to go to the dentist. Now's the time to take your kids for the eye exam, because you've got your benefits in this month. Take advantage of them. It's something you can plan ahead. And at one point in our final negotiations with Friedman in 1988, when we finally lost the contract, someone came down from La Paz and complained that the David Friedman workers used the insurance plan more than any other workers in the state. And I said, I'm proud of that. That's wonderful. That means they really know what the benefits are, and they're using them. And he said, oh, well, there might be abuses. And I said, gosh, you're sounding like Reagan complaining about the welfare mothers. You know, these are our benefits that we've earned, and we should use them. And you should be very glad that the stewards are doing their job getting that message out. Another thing I wanted to mention, that the union had training programs for stewards. I remember Ruth Shy was one of the ones that led this, and also training programs for ranch committee members, for negotiations. But I think one of the things that's like an underlying theme of the whole union history is that the union was a school, and just mm-hmm. joining the union and going to union members was an educational process, that whether you have a green card or are from Yemen or speak English or whatever, you have basic rights as a union member and as a producer of food and as a human being. And we were constantly extending those rights. We were constantly fighting sexism and racism. The union at the David Friedman Company insisted that women had the right to prune, and I think we were the first ranch committee in the state that insisted that women could take dispatches in the pruning, and the company said, oh, they don't know how, and they can't keep up, and, well, we proved that women could prune, and maybe not as fast as the young 20-year-old macho, but maybe faster than somebody else. And there were women that in quality did outstanding pruning. But people that became active in the union, in so many cases, it just changed their lives on so many levels and changed the lives of their kids. That your kids, I mean, the basic message was, we're proud to be farm workers, and planting the seeds and picking the fruit is an honorable profession, and that's where civilization starts. Mm-hmm. And nothing to be ashamed of. But if your children want to go to college, want to go to university, want to be doctors and lawyers, the whole world is out there at their fingertips, and the union's here to help you. So it was a much broader vision than just nickels and dimes. And I think at the David Friedman Company, it was really some of the union's finest hours, in that we were really serving the workers. Things were working right there. And all the mistakes we'd made in those early contracts in the 1970s, we were resolving them at the David Friedman Company, and the company was still making a profit. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason why that can't happen.
And in 88, UFW lost the contract.
And I was in those negotiations, and I think I still have all the notes of those negotiations, and they were much more difficult. But we reached, and again, we had the strength in the company to work or not work, and to work 12 hours or 6 hours or 2 hours or 1 hour, and to work slow or to work fast or to work clean or to work sloppy. And the committee could meet and decide what we were going to do. But we came to an impasse with the company in which we had reached agreement on wages and insurance and almost everything except one final clause on the paid, it was called the paid representative. The company would pay, he's still going? The company would pay a regular wage to a worker who would represent the workers in grievances with the company. And traditionally, the paid rep was elected by the workers. But in fact, in 1988, the paid rep was not a freedman worker. He was appointed by La Paz. Mm-hmm. And he was a kind of heavy rev that came out in a che beard and fatigues and was put on a very radical kind of appearance. But in fact, the message we got from La Paz was that they didn't really want a contract and that they wanted to boycott grapes. And having one contract, Friedman was the last contract they had, and it just complicated their message. And that if the committee wanted to hold out for this last clause, La Paz would back them up. And so it became a debate on the committee whether to take what in effect was the company's last and final order with the harvest running out, a day left, 2 days left, or to give in and give up the paid rep. And the other members of the committee felt that even though we did all, it was almost a wage freeze we'd accepted. We got a nickel raise in the wages, but we'd taken it out of the pension plan. So it really, we weren't getting any more money. But other members of the committee couldn't accept giving up any clause that had existed in the previous contract. It seemed like a step backwards. And I pointed out that on other ranches in the valley, the workers themselves paid the rep. Mm-hmm. And it would have cost the freedmen workers maybe a quarter a week, some little bit out of their pockets. And I said, put it to a vote. And two crews actually did vote and voted overwhelmingly, take the contract and run. I mean, time's running out, and if we lose the contract, we've lost something invaluable. But I was the only vote on the committee to accept the contract. So I was accused of being the traitor and the vendido and the sellout and a kind of sad point.
On the committee?
I was on the ranch committee.
And people on the committee made that accusation?
Oh, yeah. Well, there were five of us, and the other four votes were not to take the contract, not to take this last and final order, to demand this final clause. Well, the harvest ended, the camp was bulldozed, there's no longer a camp at the David Friedman Company, there was immediately, was no longer a grievance procedure, the company felt no obligation to meet for grievances, we had always resisted any minimum amount of work set in numbers of vines or numbers of boxes or anything. The standard was an honest day's work for an honest day's pay or a fair day, something like that, but with no specific minimums. And as soon as the contract lapsed, when we went back to work in the pruning, you had 100 vines a day. Well, I could do it, but a lot of the older people couldn't do it. A lot of the women couldn't do it. All of a sudden, there was a speed up, which the union had never tolerated before. But now, with no contract and no grievances and just a tremendous desanimo. And I stayed on for one more year without the contract. And the company continued to deduct the dues from our wages and send them to La Paz. And we continued to have insurance benefits. They continued to pay into the insurance fund. But we lost all these peripheral benefits which had made the difference between a strong union and no union. It wasn't quite a no union situation, but it was no contract and no negotiations. And then the company sold most of the ranch without a successor clause. so that people with a strong union history that wanted to work at the new company, and my crew, Sammy Rodriguez's crew, was at the new company, would have to go and apply and fill out a form, and the company, the new company, said, we invite you to apply. But in fact, even among the people whose applications they accepted, they fired over 500 people that first season. Sammy's crew, the entire crew was fired in the thinning. And I never went back. Mm-hmm. Very sad. Sammy, they apparently had demanded that Sammy fire great numbers of people in his crew, many of whom were family members, his aunt and his mother and his kids and cousins. And I mean, it was a family crew. And he refused, and they fired him and the crew. That was it. Yeah. So that's when my career at the David Friedman Company ended. And I gather their negotiations again, and maybe the contract will go back into effect. But losing that contract had a tremendous ripple effect throughout the Coachella Valley. Mm-hmm. Because whatever Friedman was paying as the largest grower in the valley, the other growers tended to pay pretty close to that, mm-hmm. even though they weren't paying the insurance and they weren't paying the other benefits. But gosh, with no contract, the wages in the grapes began to decline, and people were paying $4.85 and $4.70, and in other industries also. Everything in the valley was affected by the fact that we'd lost that contract at Friedman, a tremendous erosion of benefits, which I just thought was a terrible mistake for the union, for the workers, for whoever, not to go ahead and sign that contract. It wasn't an ideal contract. It was a step back. It was a loss, but it was the best we could do at that point in history. And to give that up, I think, was a tremendous mistake.
So you had spent some time into 1989 working.
Right.
And then your crew was just not hired by a successor company.
Right.
What did you do?
Well, I decided to just work on my own farm in the Dates, and by that time we had bought a little 5-acre farm in 1977, which had 9 date palms. And by that time I'd planted about 130 date palms. And so I just began focusing my attention on growing and selling my own crop of dates. And I'm still a union member, I still pay my dues. And luckily my wife is a nurse, and when the dates are not making a profit, and they haven't made a profit yet, it's a very slow process to build up a date ranch. Luckily, my wife has been supporting the family and making the difference. But we're marketing almost 10,000 pounds of dates now, and my partner is also a union member. And I'm taking in about $25,000. We sell by mail order and in farmers markets. And while we're not showing a profit, he's getting about a little over $7,000 he got last year. And for me, it's almost covering expenses. Mm-hmm. It's not putting money in my pocket, but the ranch is building up, and I guess on a balance sheet and equity, the farm is paid for, new palms are being planted. And I'm the spouse at home. I get the kids off to school in the morning, and I'm the taxi driver, and I'm happy with that, because most days I'm out in the fields and working in the dates and doing what I like to do. And that's why I joined the union, and that's where I am.
Do you foresee that there might be a time you would go back actually to pruning?
In the grapes, no. But I would like to have a union contract at my ranch. And the problem is how to work it out. At this point, there are no employees and no employers. And at times, the union has had contracts for small working farmers. But they're much more comfortable with an employee-employer relationship. Mm-hmm. Also, there's very minimal record keeping. There are no hours. My partner comes when he wants, and he leaves when he wants. And there are times when I don't even know he's been there. Mm-hmm. And the same with me. There are days that I'll work 10 or 12 hours, and there are days that I don't work. Mm-hmm. And I don't write it down regardless. And my hourly wage up to now has been zero.
Probably negative.
Right, probably negative. But at some point, I'd like to have a Union Eagle on my date boxes.
Mm-hmm. And is there any, you know, the business of growing and selling dates, is it something that you can expand and expect to have growth in, or is it something more or less because it's trees, it's sort of a, is 5,000, you know, is there some ordinary limit to how much you can expect to be?
Well, I think of my 5-acre ranch, I think I'll finish planting about 3 acres, would be about 150,
mm-hmm.
Maybe a few more, but probably around 150 producing palms. Should be able to produce enough income for the two families, the Paniawas and the Adairs. And I don't aspire to be a boss.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be an employer. My favorite job on the ranch is being the irrigator. If I could train my daughter or one of my partner's daughters to be the bookkeeper, that would help us. But I think 3 acres is about all I'm interested in handling.
And if you get beyond that, that's when you really have to start thinking about having labor and how to...
He may want more acres than that. And if he gets behind beyond that, because he says a single palmero could do about a dozen, even more acres.
Oh.
But that's not with the marketing. And certainly, it would be a full-time job for me to market that many dates, and I'd rather spend less time marketing and more time in the fields. So I'm not interested in marketing that many dates. So I'm not looking at it as growing and growing and growing.
Mm-hmm.
We've planted about what I'd like to plant. I'd love to see a situation where it's a cooperative and other union members and other palmeros like him have their own land and are growing their own dates, and mm-hmm. I'm helping set up a cooperative and giving advice and sharing what knowledge I have to help them market their dates. But I'm not interested in marketing somebody else's dates, to tell the truth.
You don't want to make that your business.
I like selling dates, but I'd rather spend my time growing them. So, good place to end
garden?
It. And a little garden, and we have pomegranates, we have grapes, sugar cane, flowers. I'm one of those crazy people that plants flowers, but I mm-hmm. love flowers, just flowers, bulbs, and Dutch iris, and cannas, and callas, and lots of herbs. All organic, of course. This is something that they've been growing dates for 5,000 years without chemicals, and why start now? So I'm, and the name of the company is Pato's Dream Date Gardens, and that's, up to now, it's still more dreams than dates, but mm-hmm. more and more dates every year.
And
so,
you can pick these up if you go to the farmer's market in
Alhambra and Burbank. There's my plug.
There's the plug.
But this is a good place to end it, I think, for
okay,
this. I owe it all to the union.